It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Well, good afternoon to our listeners, and welcome back to Alaska Tracks. This program is based on recordings from oral history interviews with veteran outdoorsmen and women from throughout the state. Today's guest is Marlon Grasser, a well-known hunting guide who hunted in a variety of places but is usually associated with the Alaska Peninsula and the Eastern Brooks Range. Marlon was seemingly destined for his career. He loved to hunt from an early age and never lost that drive. In this first segment, Grasser tells how he came to Alaska. He also describes a few of the people and places which played a big role in his early guiding career.
You actually were born in the lower 48?
Yeah, I came up here when I was 17.
I assume you hunted, fished, trapped when you were a kid?
Did hunting and fishing, never did trap. Participated, did it with my dad. He always ran a trap line in North Dakota. Because during the Depression, money was pretty scarce, and you did whatever you could to make a dollar. And of course, back in those days, a dollar went a long way. My uncle came up this country in the 30s. He had the old Grasser Hardware at 4th and D in Anchorage. That was the days when there was one traffic light there at 4th and D and four blocks of pavement down to the federal building, and you got off of that, you were out of town. He always come out and told me how good the hunting was, and I grew up with one of his brothers bird dogging for him there since I was a little kid. Why, I'd take off from school anytime and go fishing to hunting. Of course, mother didn't approve of that at all, but I would have came up here sooner, but I had to finish high school before she'd let me go. And I grew up here at Chickaloon. My uncle there and another friend of his, they bought or leased old Jack Corey's Roadhouse, and they ran it there, and I stayed up there, and then I hunted. That's where I hunted out of there, up in the Chugats across the river and up in the Talkeetna Mountains. And a lot of my experience I learned from old Jack Corey, who was been in the country since early 1900s and knew all that country, and Johnny Shaganoff there, native of this, from Copper Center, that knew all this country. And so that's the way I started learning it. And then on my own, I just take off with the horses and go to some place to go hunting, like I went across.
It sounds like you had cabins most of the places.
Well, just to cook in and stuff. Tents is nice if you don't have any, air better than no shelter, but hard to beat a nice warm cabin with a wood fire going.
Now, would you build those places by yourself?
Yep, by myself and the help. Built them out of the material up there, and I packed in roofing with the horses to roof them with.
How big were they?
Most of them 12 or 14. Just comfortable, you know, you can put four bunks up in them and have a table in there and a stove over there in the corner. Real comfortable.
Marlon spent many years hunting the Wrangell Mountains and the Copper River country. In this next segment, he shares some of those experiences.
Now, when you said you swam across the Copper River, I assume that was with the horses.
With the horses, yeah.
Not many people want to challenge that river, so that must have taken some guts.
Well, I can't swim either, so, but I don't think it'd do you much good in that river. So my horse quit me, that was it. But horses are powerful swimmers, and you want to pick your places to cross. Try to pick all the wading spots I could find. But anyway, in the end, I found one place that I thought was pretty good that I didn't have much trouble crossing.
Still must have given your heart a flutter. Especially the first time.
Yeah, well, especially that water is full of silt, you can't see a darn thing in it, and you just kind of read it by the surface of the water. Sometimes you do make a mistake, get a little excited. One time coming out, it was getting late in the season, and we had a big snow, wet heavy snow up there at Mount Drum and Sanford, and we packed up, got down the river, and it turned warm and started to rain, and that river just come up overnight, and we sat there for 3 days. First time in there, while we packed in from Canada, we trucked the horses over to Jackal Creek, come up on the Beaver Creek Trail into the White River. Then I went over that big glacier, because when we had that big 64 earthquake, it took the trail out, and it took me a week to find a way across to with the horses across that glacier. And that was kind of exciting at times. And we come to this one place here, and we keep hearing this roar, and it's getting louder and louder, and we got over there, a whirlpool, like a big dish, draining down the center there, and like this whirlpool must have been 60, 70 feet across easy, and just roaring, going down through the ice, and over there on that glacier in the Skolai, between the White River and the Chittistall. Like I said, crossing that glacier, that was something. It took about 3 hours of steady traveling to get across it from one side to the other. The horses took it rather calmly, and you couldn't just go straight across because you'd have to detour around those crevasses. And I tried to stay on that gravel moraine because that did give them some footing, whereas that ice, you'd think it'd be kind of soft and slushy on top because it was hot days over in that country in the summer. But that ice was just as brittle as glass. Go someplace to go hunting, like I went across over to the Copper River after this place got too populated and that, and you had to move, and I swam that Copper River and went up in Mount Sanford, Mount Drum, and around there, and hunted there a couple of years, and then I went down when they got the bridge across the Copper down there at Chittenden. By then I packed into the Wrangles from there up beyond McCarthy into the Chittistone and the old Skull Eye Pass over into the White River and hunted.
Tell us about some of the hunting over on the Sanford and Drum.
Well, I first crossed over there. It was good hunting. Nobody had been in there in years. Airplanes have been there, but they're limited to how far they can go. And with the horses, I was unlimited where I go. I've been completely around Drum and up on that bench between Sanford and Drum. I've been all around those mountains and far down as Long Glacier with the horses. Those rivers, you know, littler ones, there are no problem cross them with a horse. Whereas you get out there on foot, it'd knock you down. It's so swift. But anyway, I got into some real good hunting over there. The sheep hunting was good, bear hunting was good, moose was good, and the caribou was kind of scattered, but there was some good bulls over there. But overall, it was just a good experience.
Now, would your clients fly in?
Fly in, yeah. I made a strip on a gravel bar, cleaned it off so that the small plane can get in and out of.
How about sheep over in the Wrangles?
Sheep hunting is just crawling around rocks and making a good stock. It's always exciting. You don't see them maybe for a half a day. You're circling around trying to get above them, so you come down on them, and they ain't going to get away from you. And it's just a kind of exciting always to come around on them. It don't have to be exceptional sheep, just any of them, even if you're just going to take pictures. We took some big sheep out of that White River, and these two rams, one was 44 and a half, and one was 43 and a half, and their bases were right at 15 inches. I wasn't into scoring trophies, but I would venture to say they scored way up there in the Boone and Crockett book. Anybody took them in. That would have been way back in the late 60s. I just can't remember the exact years.
That's great stuff from a guy who loved to hunt. In this next segment, Marlon talks about his years of guiding in the Brooks Range.
Did you have any encounters with bears up in the Brooks Range?
A friend of mine had a problem with them, but I never have. They come around camp, I come out there hollering at them, and they'd always run off. Well, Zeke Setchels had one. He's in a sleeping bag in his tent and dragging him out of the tent when he shot it. And the fishing game, they raised hell with him. Wasn't supposed to be shooting bears unless it endangered your life. Well, I don't know what the hell more endangered you'd be when one's dragging you out of the tent in your sleeping bag. That's enough danger for me right there. But like I say, I just holler at them, and hell, they'd take off.
How about your area up in the Hula Hula? Tell us a little bit more about that.
That is in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. We first went up there. Why? There was nobody up there in those days. We flew it in the late 60s. I knew about that area because I worked with a man that prospected up there, and he told me about it. So I knew a little bit about it. Anyway, it looked very good for sheep, and that's what I needed was a sheep area. And so we flew a load of horses into Arctic Village, trailed them over the mountain over there, Gilbo Pass, through the mountain into the Hula River from Channel R. Of course, the horses there ate and got fat. We didn't really need them because we'd walk out of camp there and get sheep. It turned out a real good area. And today, though, with the wolf predation, the sheep numbers, I was talking to some fish and wildlife people that the sheep numbers there are down about half of what they were when I was there. We'd always leave the area around camp and not hunt it that much and save it for the last. Even the last years I hunted there, I took just as good a sheep out of that area as I always have. No problem with the sheep. And virtually we had 100% on our sheep hunting up there. So if they don't do something about the wolves, that's what's taking the numbers down is wolf predation.
What kind of a camp did you have there?
I had those weatherports for base camp. That's what we'd have for a kitchen was weatherports and sleeping arrangements, which are just like cabins. Those weatherports are just real comfortable. You can hang your clothes up and put a heater in them. They're nice and warm. Just make real good camps. Ed, he'd take two hunters, and he'd have one person helping him, and I'd take two, and I'd have one person help me. And
so you'd have four hunters in camp at one time?
Right, for usually 8 days. We'd book them for 8 days. The first sheep hunts, of course, sheep season would open a minute after midnight, and up there you have 24 hours of sunshine, so the hunters get in 2 days before the season starts, and they always like to hike around. We'd hike around some and look it over and pick out some sheep that we was going to hunt, and evening before the opening, why, we'd get up there and make our stock, and when it got a minute after midnight, why, that's when we'd shoot a sheep. Those guys, they couldn't get over that. Their first day of hunting, and it's all over with them. They're all through. It's beautiful country up there. course, wintertime, it's cold and harsh, and you wonder how in the world anything ever lives up there. But summertime, that Hoola Valley was a nice, lush, green valley. No brush to fight, no sticker bushes. It was different hunting. Enjoyable. Weather is drier up there. In fact, I was talking to some geologists, and they claimed it to be a desert area up there with the amount of precipitation. It wasn't that it was froze for so long. And in fact, I hunted the desert country down lower U.S. and Mexico, and there is a similarity. There's a lot of plants up there that you will find in desert areas. And it isn't that cold in the mountains. You get up there, why, heck, it's nothing to be up in the 70s there on a good sunny day. And of course, come September, though, our last hunt would be the first September. We'd get out of there by the middle of September. Why, it can start getting cold then, too, up in the brooks there.
Do you remember any particular hunt from up there?
Yeah, we hunted some prominent people physically, hunted some older women even, and they all got sheep. And like I say, there's nothing outstanding about them. You pick one out and just go get him. There's no danger involved. Those mountains were really easy mountains to hunt. They're good footing, vegetation all over them. There wasn't like down the Chugats or some of these Alaska range where it's rock and cliffs and that. It was rather easy hunting. That's why I told those people there for a sheep hunt, they'd complain about it. And I said, you ought to get down the Chugats and Wrangles and hunt some of that country, and then you'd appreciate this.
How about the size of sheep?
I've taken some good horns. That one right up there came out of the Brooks Range there, right above my camp.
And how big is he?
He's 38 and a half, and we have taken a number of them at 40 plus, but the bases are not as heavy as they are down here. And even the Talkeetna Mountains will not have as heavy a base as a Chugat ram as a rule. And the Wrangell rams have good bases. The growing season is so much shorter up there than down here too, which is a big influence on it, and mineral content in the soil. Like I say, you can see they're pretty sheep. There's nothing wrong with them. And it was a good producing sheep area. There's no question of that. Like I say, I didn't take Boone and Crockett out of there, but I took just some good representative of the all sheep. And that's all I ever advertised about my hunting. I just try to get them a full curl or better, or a good ram. I said, there ain't Boone and Crockett up there. Anyway, well, it turned out pretty good. We went up the Hoola River up there in the Brooks Range. They couldn't believe that we were legally hunting sheep when everybody would get sheep and we'd take them in a day or two. I hunted up there, I don't know how many years. I didn't even bring the airplane up. Well, I'd just take two hunters at a time walking out of base camp where Walt dropped off everybody. And they just couldn't believe that you could have success like that. Well, gee whiz. At one time I set up my camp, young Tracy Moffat come in. Worked about 2 days getting our camp all set up, everything cleaned up and put away. And that evening we were glassing around while I seen 64 full curl or better rams just sitting right there at camp. So if you got a population of sheep like that, hell, you don't have to use a damn airplane to go find sheep. All you have to do is get off your butt and go up the hill and get them.
Okay, let's take a break now for a few words from our sponsors. Now back to our Alaska Tracks program and our guest, Marlon Grasser. In this next segment, Grasser tells us about his long-term guiding operation on the Alaska Peninsula.
And like I say, I just moved around, and the longer you're in it, why, the more you learn. And like I say, you're always looking for some good place to go to. And so I went down the Alaska Peninsula hunting hunt bear, moose, and caribou. And Kodiak there.
You mentioned a lodge. Now, where was that located?
Painter Creek, southwest of Mother Goose Lake. Drains into Yagashik Bay and out into the bay there at Pilot Point. And I started hunting there in the 60s.
Now, did you build that lodge?
Or? Yes. Joe Maxey and Ed and myself and Milton Moss and J.W. Smith. Milton Moss, Ed and I bought him out. And in the end, Joe Maxey, Ed and I owned it. When we left there, Joe and one of the fish guides bought it. It was a nice place. I have pictures of it. Real comfortable. We had four cabins for four groups of people. And we had five boats on the river, two 180s, at least a 180, and the Super Cub. And Joe had a 172 with a big engine in it on floats. So we had all five species of salmon we fished there. And we had Arctic char. And we flew out for rainbow and grayling. And we'd fly out for silvers over the Pacific side over Main Creek. And chum salmon, we'd fish them just a short ways from the sea. And they come in there, they're just bright silver and fighting. And I had many of those people, they fish there, and it's so darn good that they just lay their pole down and lay down and rest. They just wore them out.
How about some more experiences from down on the peninsula? You must have had some big caribou down there.
We've taken some nice caribou. We had this one German gal one time. We took a nice bull for her. And Leo Lucas, this other old guide, recommended come down and hunt with me. And so anyway, we scored it while she was touring around the country. And we'd come up with about 467 points. We didn't add any. In fact, we scored it light. It was symmetrical. That's why you didn't lose any point. Two nice shovels on it. The bezes were the same, and the same points on there, and good beam on it. It was an outstanding rack. Like I say, we've taken a number of them down there, Boone and Crockett, Caribou, and moose too. There's big moose country down there.
Do you remember a particular hunt for moose that sticks in your memory as being exciting?
Oh, there's a number of them.
Well, can you share one of those stories with us?
Well, one time I had this two men, they had hunted with me a number of times. We needed a moose for one of them. There was four big moose down on the far meadow we could spot from the airstrip down there at Painter Creek on the Alaska Peninsula. So it was getting late in the day, and towards evening we got down there, and I never carried a gun. I had a packer with me. He didn't have a gun. The hunter's the only one that had a gun with him. Moose has never been any problem. And so anyway, we got down there, and they were moving, and we come around some alders and willow and stuff and over a little ways, and then they were on the other side of this other meadow with about 250-yard shot for him, and he's shooting a 340 Weatherby. Well, he shot, and down the old moose goes, and he was an exceptional bull because he was big in body size along with antlers. Anyway, I was walking up to him. Why, Vern wanted to get some pictures of him, so he gave me his gun, and I'm in the lead walking over there, and that old moose, we got about 30 feet from him, he jumps up, and I'm looking up in those big old bloodshot eyes, and I hollered to Vern, "You getting any pictures?" I was waiting for him to get pictures before I shot him, and I hollered again, and I turned around and looked. They were both running the other way as far as they could go. I just turned around and shot from the hip and dropped him. But that was an exceptional moose. The rack with just a skull plate weighed an honest 100 pounds. And I packed in the hams with the hide on, and then I'd hang it up at camp and skin it out. After that, one ham hung for 10 days, and it weighed 168 pounds. So I'd say it easily weighed 200 pounds when it was green with the hide on that I packed in.
Do you remember how big the antlers were on that one?
Yeah, it was 68 and a half inches spread, and it had huge palms on it with good points all the way around, and on the eye guards they cupped up, so when you scored it you measured the length of the cups on the brow guards along with the length of the palm. You got all that for score, and we just rough scored it, but it was right at the top of the book there, Boone Crockett. It was really a magnificent animal.
Do you remember any other bears?
I had a hunter. He turned down a fairly nice bear, and the last day we had one above camp. It was about an 8-foot bear is all. It wasn't a big bear. And we were up there in the afternoon glassing, and finally we seen it come out of the brush and on an opening there, and we got a shot at it. And it went back in the brush, and I knew he hit it. So I'm in that alder going back and forth and combing it. I come through some alder, and hell, there's that bear right under my feet. Hell, I didn't have time for the hunter. It wasn't dead. He was looking at me, and I had a rifle right there in my hand. I just pulled the trigger and shot him, but my next step would have been right on top of him. Kind of gives you a start there for a moment or two. If I can think of them all, there have been a few times when you get a little bit excited about things.
Any real close calls with the bears?
I had a few down on the Alaska Peninsula. One big bear there, and I had a hunter from California, and we down checking the old gut pile of a moose that the other party had got, and nothing been on it, and we all circled it and never go in it, so our scent wasn't around it. We had about 2 or 3 inches of snow that night, and circled around and there and ran into the tracks of that big old bear, and so I figured, well, he's going to come back tonight, so we had snow to track by. I knew he was going up in the valley and lay up, and I thought, well, maybe we could get on him. So we went up after him, and we was on him for about 2 hours or so, and when he knew we was on it, he was trying to lose us. He'd go up the hill and down the hill, back switch and everything on it, and we come to a big opening, and he was up the head of the valley at that time, and when we come out of the brush, he was looking right over his shoulder right at us there, about 400 or 500 yards off. He just knew right where we was going to come out, it seemed like. He had about 2 or 3 ways he could have gone and get away from us, and then we got up there about where he went in the brush, last seen him about 200 yards. I had the hunter stand there and watch, so I went in the brush there, followed his trail, and well, he got in there, while he just stopped and was sitting on his butt when I come up out of a deep wash and looked at him there about 20, 30 feet away, and he just let out a big woof and charged, and I had my rifle ready, and I just swung and shot from the hip, and down he goes, and I figured that's the end of you, and go to give him another one, and the rifle quit me, and didn't work, and I got a little excited then, and I put another round in, same thing, third time I figured, well, there's something wrong with my rifle. Too late to run then, because the old man bear, he was coming after me, and no place to go in the brush, and I put my arm up from my face, and he just slapped that out of there, and when I went over backwards, my left leg flew right up by his head. Well, he turned and grabbed it then, instead of coming up for my face. Anyway, why, he had his teeth there sunk into my leg, and I'm laying back on my back watching with my leg in his mouth. I figured he's going to bite my leg off, just sure shooting, because hell, he could bite a limb off as big as my arm or that, no trouble. And I sure my leg ain't that tough. And I didn't even know where I'd hit him. Pretty well, hell, I must have just grazed him. But anyway, he bit me about 6-7 times, and I just laid there when he let a big woof and walked over me, and hell, what are you going to do? That animal weighed about 1,500 pounds, and you ain't going to wrestle him, that's for damn for sure. So anyway, I just stayed there, didn't move. I looked as far as I could. Finally there, I don't know how much time lapsed. I couldn't see anything, and I just turned a little bit, and I could see he went down the trail, blood all over every place. Didn't know if it was mine or his or whose it was at the time. Then I looked at my leg, and I could move my foot, so I figured nothing's broke. I looked at my rifle then, and what it was going through that wet alders, one of those seeds off of alder pod stuck the sear down. Your bolt slides in and doesn't cock the firing pin. And I just took the bolt out and slapped it on the stock of the rifle, and that jarred it loose, and should have picked up my rounds that I jacked on the ground there, because I only had three left then. After I jacked those three out. Anyway, well, I went back down and asked the hunter to go get Ed, my son, in the airplane so he wouldn't lose him, because I didn't know how bad he was hurt, because there's blood all over. And anyway, the hunter took off, and the plane was out with the caribou hunter, and he flew over because it was a beautiful sunny day. Flew over showing him some of the country, and I got his attention by waving at him with my coat. Of course, when he looked down, he could see blood all over the ground with snow down there. And anyway, he hollered at me that he's at the top of the alder patch. So I go way around the alder patch, and I start zigzagging in, coming into the alder patch, and I got about 60, 70 feet from there, and boy, he come out of there charging, just driving off his hind legs. And when he came up, I shot, and he turned, and I shot again. And I couldn't tell if I hit him or not. I tried to go around the patch, get ahead of him before he could get down through it into the creek, because the creek was real brushy. And I couldn't do it. My leg was starting to bother me, and I got around there. He'd already beat me. So I go down there. I'm walking along the creek, sunshine in my eyes, and I figured, hell, I'll get across the creek and get on the other side and look down with the sun at my back, and I could see better. Get over there, start crawling up the other side, and there's a damn bear track just as big as his that came down the creek and went up into one of those alder draws that come off the hills, and I only had one shell left now, and I figured, oh, crap, I ain't going in there after him with just one shell. So I backed out of there, I walked down the creek, and I come back thinking about it. Here he walks out right underneath me about 40, 50 feet, because the valley come down gradual slope and then just dropped right off to the creek bottom there. And I hollered at him again, and he started to stand up, and then he was just too weak, and he just goes real slow, and I took my time and shot him right behind the shoulder. Then I sat there and whistled and throwed sticks down there at him, because all I had was my knife in my hand then. And went down there finally and looked him over, and his butt must have been as wide as this countertop. He was a big bear. I'd say he weighed close to 1,500 pounds, because after he was salted two or three days, his hide from toe to toe was still 11 foot 2 inches across. My kid, he come out there looking for me then, because the hunter got back to camp and said, a bear killed your dad. And here I talked to him and everything. Well, he got out of Seagram's, got drunk. The hunter did, and Pinero stops and checked on me there. And Tibbetts flew for me then, brought my hunters in and out. He stopped just to have a cup of coffee and visit and see if we needed anything. And that hunter got on the plane, and I haven't seen him to this day. I called him up and asked him if he wanted his bear. No, he didn't want that bear. So I had a rug made out of it, and it's up on the floor there. Anyway, that's just one. But like I say, you fool around them bears, why, you have some close calls every once in a while.
Marlin also spent time on Kodiak Island. Here's a few short stories about that area, and then he wraps up today's episode with a reflection on his life in the outdoors.
We was down deer hunting Kodiak this fall, and this friend of mine, we were hunting deer. There's a lot of bear around. Anyway, we seen these bucks up on a ridge, and we circled around, got on them. We got two nice bucks, and shot another little one there. And anyway, why, we drug one that was up higher on the ridge and throwed it with the other one. I was going to butcher them out right there together. And Christ, we were just getting started, and here comes this big old brown bear. And he wasn't going to leave. He tried to come in on me, and I'd hit him off and holler at him and that, and I shot underneath of him. Hell, he didn't pay any attention to that at all. So I wasn't going to waste any more shells. After a big hassle, I finally started walking off and went over the ridge, and I figured, well, I'll get these dressed out. And I had my friend pack them over about 500-600 yards. It's one of those big old dark green mossberry patches. We packed over to there. I was on the last deer dressing it out, and it was kind of on a little knoll, and here comes that damn bear again. He came up behind me, in fact, and the hunter is coming back for another load. He hollered, that bear's right behind you again. And I jumped up and looked, and there he was. And this other gut pile right here, and I'm right here about, oh, I'd say 40 feet apart. Instead of coming around there, I'd let him have that right away, but he is bone determined he's going to come right there. So we're going back and forth again there, arguing out who in the hell is going to keep that deer. And finally he got wind of that other one. He come into it then, and he's got a picture of me dressing it out, and there's the bear right down there eating on the other gut pile.
Did you do any other hunting on Kodiak?
Basically, it was bear, and where I hunted bear clear down the south end, there was no deer there years ago when I hunted bear there. And they started coming in, oh, I can't remember the year, but after they started, why, it was no problem then. The deer are just real thick down there because it's ideal deer habitat. When they have a bad year on Kodiak for deer, it doesn't affect them way down there like it does up in the north end of the island. That snow there on the south slope goes away, and they ain't snowbound like they are on the north side. It makes a big difference.
Some big bears there on Kodiak, too.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I've taken some big bears there. We got this one bear, had this hunter, Carolina, and he wanted a big bear. We're out there, his two friends had taken nine and a half foot bear. We got up on this one bear this real crisp morning, and he's out there on a little creek feeding on mice on the edge side. We got up within, I'd say 100, 125 yards from him, and a big hummock there, I had him lay down, he was shooting a 375, and he shot this bear, and the steam just come out of him, and just like that, that bear took off. He's hit hard, didn't knock him down either. And I never had a rifle with me. My assistant guide had a rifle, and Dennis shooting a 7mm, and I said, let him have it, Dennis. And Dennis shot him with that 7mm and just rolled him right over. Anyway, he got up, got into the brush, and I get down there. I'm walking down that little creek. It's about, 6-7 foot wide and about hip width deep. And walking down there, no sign. I start walking back, and there he was laying in the creek. We got in there, the water came right next to the bank, one place where we could slide him right out, even with the water. Four of us was pulling on that bear carcass, and we could not get him up out of there. So we get in the creek, skinned him out, the hams off of him, and it took two of us just to float the hams over and drag them out of the creek, and the shoulders, and then we figured, it's just like one blob, he should be able to pull that out. Four of us couldn't even pull that out. We had to finish skinning him in that creek, and of course I'd hide soaking wet, and we got in the pack board, and old Charlie Wood was one of my guides there too, and we took turns packing, and I'd pack a ways and he'd pack a ways. And we got up there on a ridge, and we're quite a ways from camp. It's getting late and getting around to camp. Just all kinds of wind blowing spruce and logs, and they're crisscross anyway, and they're slippery. And I told him we ain't going to get stuck in that stuff in the dark. And so we just left it on the ridge, and we figured we'd come back next morning and get it. And we came back next morning. The wind came up that night, and it was blowing rain and sideways there and bad, but we made it into camp. We kept telling that guy, we're just going to have to cut that hide in two. It's just too heavy to pack. He didn't like that idea.
Do you remember how big that one was?
Yeah, he squared on us 10 half foot. He's got it life-size mounted back there. I got out of school one day, and the next day I was on a plane come north, come up, go hunting and fishing, and never went home. And I made my home up here. And I don't regret it to this day. I did very good up here, I think. Enjoy the country, and of course it's getting a little populated now. Things that we took for granted and come and go as it pleased in the past, you can't do it anymore.
That's all for today's episode of Alaska Tracks. I hope you enjoyed listening to the memories of hunting guide Marlon Grasser. Join us again next week for another episode of Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.